You're listening to Expanding Horizons, the podcast of the Unitarian Church of South Australia, a home of progressive spirituality and free religious thought and action since 1854. The views expressed in these podcasts are those of the speaker and are not intended to represent the position of the church itself or of the worldwide Unitarian Universalist movement. For more information, visit unitariansa.org.au. It's really praise God, and it's not something that we dwell on here as Unitarians, at least not in that language, but we must find a language to experience the spirit of life, to experience a sense of soul, of something greater than the mundane world we see around us every day. Whatever one thinks of the story of Yeshua, or Jesus as commonly known in English, his story has inspired some of the greatest music ever composed, that's for sure. And today being Good Friday, I dwell on one aspect of that story as it's come down through the generations. I only deal with the story of the human Yeshua. What has been made of his life and his teaching since then, we leave it up to Christians and others with the theology and explanations and mysteries, whatever that might be. But on this day, which commemorates the day that he died, I suggest there's a message there for all of us. And I want to tell the story of two Jewish rabbis, Yeshua being one, and another who lived in the 1600s, because there's a contrast in how one faces death, something we all must do, something that is always resisted by the ego, which cannot bear the thought of extinction. You're all familiar with the story of this rabbi with a reformist message, to the point of it being a radical message, not readily accepted in its simplicity by the powers that be in the Jerusalem temple hierarchy of the time, 2,000 years ago. He was, in a sense, getting back to the essence of things, with two commandments above all: to love God and to deal with others as you yourself would wish to be dealt. And that second teaching in particular is something that has been seen in so many other religions, every major religion, and is still just as relevant today. It's just as challenging today. Can we really say that we treat others as we would wish to be treated? Which is, of course, with kindness, with thoughtfulness, and encouragement. There is something quite special about the teachings of Yeshua. In his wisdom, he said many things which were the epitome of mercy, and yet he also said things which told of a great severity. It is what I call situational wisdom. To the one who thought he could buy his way into spiritual richness, Yeshua made it clear that every material thing had to be given up. He was able to see the obstacle for that particular person at that time in advancing spiritually. And at the same time, the story of the woman at the well, who had been with many men, obviously in a society where promiscuity was gravely frowned upon, he treated her mercifully. So the point is not that he came out with a series of rules, but rather he came out with wise teaching, depending on what the individual person needed to hear. written down a couple of generations after his life. Sometimes the words black and white on the page can seem as if he was setting out a series of rules. And we've all heard quotes of Yeshua weaponized to judge and belittle others at times. So the teaching was special in that sense of being a situational wisdom, and yet the language that he used was not that unusual. There are plenty of examples of rabbis in the wisdom tradition. You can see some of the thoughts in the book of Ecclesiastes, for example, where there are pithy expressions, parables, ironies, apparent contradictions. And one that I think is pertinent to the theme of life and death today, I draw from the book of Thomas, scripture which I put great store in, although it's not an accepted book in the Christian tradition. It is debatable whether it was written before or after the gospel stories, but either way, as a collection of the sayings of Yeshua, there is no reason to believe it's less authentic and probably is more authentic than the books in the name of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. They all have a very clear proselytizing message. But the book of sayings of Jesus under the name of Thomas seems to be just a record of the sort of things that he said or might have said. One of those sayings, which many people would find most curious, "The dead are not alive, and the living will not die." Now, that can certainly be read in line with a standard Christian theology, the theology of salvation and everlasting life. But there's an echo of those words in the book of Matthew as well, which subverts the idea of the living and the dead. The implication is that the people that we see around us here on earth are perhaps dead, and those who have passed through this life are somehow still alive. How can one understand that contradiction? Well, one suggestion is that you can separate between bodily consciousness and spiritual consciousness. And when you think about it, there are so many people that you've met through your life who are living really entirely on an animal level, or little more than that. In their minds are the impressions of television, chatter from other people, books, magazines perhaps, and the bodily sensations of hunger, thirst, and whatever. And the instinct leads them to pursue pleasure and avoid pain. And that's life. But is that really living? In terms of a spiritual consciousness, the person is not alive. It's not a matter of judgment if one is obliquely referring to them as dead. It's just the level of consciousness they hold. Now, it is, of course, possible to evolve and develop a spiritual consciousness. And we've all started out with those basic animal concerns. And none of us here might put great claims on being spiritually conscious, but at least we're seeking the way forward. As to whether, after passing through this physical life, there continues some form of spiritual consciousness, I'll leave it as a question for another day. But what I really wanted to say about the story of Yeshua today was to underline the extraordinary courage that he had, knowing the danger of entering into Jerusalem before the Passover festival, knowing that he intended to teach contrary to the wishes of the temple hierarchy. I can never fail to be impressed by people who are willing to die for their ideals. And it's easy enough with hindsight and totally different culture and perspective and time to say, well, maybe those ideals were misplaced. nonetheless, to have the courage to overcome the ego's resistance to sacrifice, even to the point of death, extinction of the physical body. That is extraordinary. So I tell you the story of Shabbatai Tsevi, a Jewish man born in Smyrna, which is now Izmir, for many centuries a Greek city, and really only became more of a Turkish city after World War I, when there was a battle between Greeks and Turks for the future of those cities on the Aegean coast. In any case, he was Jewish, he attended yeshiva, Jewish religious school, and at the tender age of 22 declared himself Messiah. There was a lot of talk, as there pretty well always had been, of the arrival of a Messiah, Mashiach, who would not only restore Jewish people to a position of prominence, but to deliver them from the terrible purges, segregation, and discrimination which was absolutely rife throughout Europe in the 1600s and for centuries before that. Well, Shabbatai Tsevi was clearly charismatic and knowledgeable, and he developed quite a following. He moved to Constantinople, as it was then, Istanbul, but after a few years was asked to leave. He travelled variously to Salonika, now known as Thessalonica in Greece, to Cairo, another great centre, and to Jerusalem. In each case, he developed hundreds, if not thousands, of followers, but was eventually asked to move on by the authorities. It should be said that communication was a lot better than it was in the time of Yeshua, and word of Shabbatai Tsevi spread throughout Europe. Of note was the fact that Christians were also talking about millenarian prophecies, the end of the world. First it was going to be the year 1000 in the Common Era, various other calculations were done, and there was a lot of talk in the 1600s that 1666 was going to be the year of the apocalypse and whatever. So there was a bit of a fever of expectation. So when the news came from the Middle East that the Messiah had appeared, or a Messiah had appeared, it was really taken to heart by a lot of Jewish people. Many sold up their homes. Many prepared to travel to Jerusalem on a final journey. Well, in 1666, Shabbatai Tsevi put his messianic belief to the test. He had been in Gaza, which was then, we've heard about it a lot lately, but it was then primarily a Jewish city. And there was a prophet, Nathan, there who prophesied that the Sultan of the Ottoman Empire himself would place the Sultan's crown on the head of Shabbatai Tsevi. So he would be not only a spiritual Messiah, but accepted as a worldly Sultan, king as well. So when he got to Constantinople and began his preaching, he hardly had time to get words out of his mouth when the Sultan ordered him to be arrested and imprisoned. For the Sultan had heard of Natan's prophecy and was certainly not interested in meeting someone who expected the Sultan to hand over his crown to this bloke, this travelling Jewish rabbi. So he was imprisoned. But even in prison, he kept talking to everyone he could about his message. And so the Sultan summoned him one day and said, "Look, you're trouble. I'll give you three choices. You say you're the Messiah for the Jews? Very well. I'll put you to the test. Your three choices are: you can stand against the wall, and my best archers will fire a volley of arrows at you, and if you are the Messiah, you will survive, and I will accept you are the Messiah of the Jews. Your second choice is to be impaled, as I have done with many of my enemies. And without going into details, the impaling procedure was essentially from the bottom up, so that the body and face of the person could be left on a rampart facing out to the crowd, so that everyone would know that that person was an enemy of the Sultan. And the third option is to convert to Islam, because of course the Ottoman Empire was an Islamic empire, at least on the face of it. So our friend Shabbatai Tsevi thought carefully about the three options and said, "Allahu Akbar, I've discovered Islam." He did not have the courage of his convictions. The Sultan rewarded him with a financial position, a doorkeeper's job at the palace, really. All he had to do was keep quiet and collect the money. And he did live on for a number of years until he continued to annoy the Sultan. His pension was eventually stopped, and he quietly moved away and died in 1676. So one can understand his dilemma. And it does raise a question for us. How many of us would be willing to die for our ideals? Really, that's a challenge. Or would it be the Unitarian response, "Well, that's completely unreasonable, so I'll sign anything"? I'm not sure. There must be limits. And certainly perhaps to protect our family, our children, our loved ones, perhaps we would be willing to sacrifice ourselves. But getting back to the story of Yeshua, he must have known when he went into Jerusalem what he was up against. Now, when we look at the story set out in the book written in the name of Mark, and I always go to that text before the other synoptic or story gospels because it was written substantially earlier, we have already in the text the implication that Jews and Christians are something separate. So remember, we're some 40 or 50 years after the death of Jesus. Paul has been teaching. He arrived in Rome. He's already died one way or another in Rome. But the churches and the teaching that he spawned are spread throughout the Eastern Roman Empire, at least. And there was a sense among those non-Jewish new Christians that they wanted to have a distinct brand apart from their Jewish origins. And so even in Mark, we can see a certain amount of blame put on the Jewish characters in the story. But just like in any colonial regime, the easiest way to get rid of one of your rivals, if you're one of the oppressed people, is to dob them in to the colonial power. And it seems evident, at least going from the story in Mark, that that's what happened, that the Jewish leadership, rather than having a big argument in the temple, somehow got word to the governor that this guy is trouble. He's talking about a kingdom, and although I have a very different sense of what that means, and if you read the book of Thomas, you'll see it's not literally a worldly kingdom. But nonetheless, the easiest thing for the governor to do was just like the Sultan did so many centuries later to Shabbatai Tsevi, and say, "Right, bring him in, finish him off. End of the problem." And there's that interesting story in Mark of an encounter between Yeshua and Pontius Pilate. The question is asked, "Are you king of the Jews?" Now, that was the big opportunity to get out of there. That was the opportunity to avoid physical extinction in a very painful fashion in the form of crucifixion. But the answer, as it was first written down in Greek, sou legi, meaning so you say. So he had his chance to say, no, actually, I didn't mean that, let me explain. But he didn't. He said neither yes or no, and in so doing sealed his fate and suffered that terrible death on the cross. So above all, the question to contemplate today is, how far would we go if we were challenged? Is there anything we would sacrifice ourselves for? Is there anyone we would sacrifice ourselves for? We hope you've enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter. This permission can be obtained by emailing admin@unitarianSA.org.au. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching SA Unitarians or by visiting our website at unitarianSA.org.au.